Hey gang, Hydraberg here, a cut above horror review. Tonight it's just the three of us, and we're getting awfully gothic with 2015's Crimson Peak. We have a sinking feeling about episode 155 of A Cut Above, starting now.
Cut my life into pieces!
Good evening and welcome to A Cut Above Horror Review, a podcast where we review all things horror. I'm your host, Jacqueline, and tonight we'll be discussing Crimson Peak from 2015. But first, let's meet everyone else on the show. A warm hello to our good friend, John. How you doing, John?
Hola, mi amiga. ¿Qué pasa?
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. How's it
Hi,
going?
Hi, Jacqueline. It's going great. Fantastic. The weather's getting warmer. Thursday is summer, the official kickoff to summer, and I'm excited.
It's also somebody's birthday around here.
That's Friday, actually, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, I was close. Sorry. Yeah. But it's coming up.
It is.
Oh, cool. Up. Happy yeah. birthday, whoever this is, this mystery person.
This mystery person who should, yes. We should force him to watch Midsommar on his birthday.
Who knows that person is?
Who cannot guess.
Person could be anybody. Any one of us could be.
Well, my birthday's in February, so it's not me.
Not you. But yeah, summer is up. John, I can tell you've been outside. You've got a healthy glow to you. Looks like you got a little tan.
I did. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for noticing, even though we're an audio platform.
Yes.
But I appreciate that.
I can still see you.
The listeners want to know.
Yes, they want to know what's going on with John's tan.
Okay, my tan's looking pretty darn good. The man bun's growing.
I love it.
What else is new? That's about it for me.
You're not wearing your professorial glasses today.
No, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Today's a contacts day, so that's what I have in.
All right. And next up, of course, we have our dear friend Hydraberg. Baronet Berg. How you doing?
Peekaboo. Crimson peekaboo.
He's playing a little game with us tonight.
Hey guys,
how you doing, Hydraberg?
I'm good. How are you guys, Jacqueline? You're comfy.
I'm very comfy. I'm in my robe again, like last week. I've decided to give up trying to be civilized.
Love it.
It's good.
I'm not wearing sleeves.
I gave up
on sleeves.
Good. That's you should. What's the point, really?
I'm not wearing pants.
Nice.
No, because I'm wearing shorts. It's summertime. Oh, come on. Come on.
I guess my the gutter, John. I'm sorry.
Look at Jacqueline. She's turning all red. Oh, my God. I can't believe that.
Hydraberg, are you going to do anything special to celebrate your birthday later this week?
I'm playing D&D that day.
That's a good activity.
We had an epic session last week.
Yeah?
I rolled like five. I was in the chat talking about it when it was happening. Rolled like 420s in combat, which is like really hard to do. Mm-hmm. It was pretty clutch. So we got another session in person. So hopefully I do something cool then. I don't know. If not, just don't die.
I also hope you don't die on your birthday.
Yeah, well, my character I meant in D&D, but as well in real life.
I hope neither you nor your character dies on your birthday.
IRL.
Yep, like Shakespeare. He died on his birthday.
Oh shit.
Did he really?
Mm-hmm.
How poetic.
I know.
Wherefore art thou, Romeo?
I should have mentioned that on the Romeo and Juliet episode.
He must have heard from the future that they were going to do a parody of his on Troma. And he was like, no more.
I can't go on living knowing this. That's probably.
When Uncle Lloyd finally passes, he's got a couple of words for him.
Yeah.
Y'all, we should write a screenplay about that. Time traveling Shakespeare. He finds out news from the future that Troma is going to reap from
the Juliet. Troma can produce it.
Yeah, and he gets deeply depressed. I think that's a winner right there.
And he fights the Toxic Avenger.
Not Shakespeare in Love. We'll call it Shakespeare in Despair. How's that?
Oh, well done, Jacqueline.
In future the Oscar.
Directed by Rob Zombie.
I'll give you that one, John. It was a little early, but I like the way you got it in there.
Yeah.
It's creative.
Hydraberg, I appreciate your noise of consideration there.
I judged it really quickly. I lied on that one.
Wait until after, towards the end of the episode, if you still feel that way.
It was so early, but you know, sometimes quickly is good. So,
yep. Y'all are cracking me up tonight. All right. So, yep. Good to see you guys. It's just us three tonight, but we are here to talk about Crimson Peak from 2015. But first, John, do you have any horror news for us?
I do. And Heidelberg, I got to give you all the credit in the world because I actually had one story, but I decided to move it. But we know when Jordan Peele's next movie is coming out. That would be October 23rd, 2026.
Jesus Christ, that is so far away. Why is it 2.5 years away?
I have no idea, but dude, I'm excited.
I mean, I guess I'll park it on my calendar for 2.5 years from now. Damn.
I, like, tweeted that. And then Monkey Paw, I know, like, their Instagram had it on there with some, like, eerie music, too. So I was like, I wonder if the music meant anything. But I've seen that music. You know, you can use it on Instagram, so.
Oh, sure. Well, no, it was kind of a cryptic post just because it was just the date, like, in red. So
like a brownish, was it? It was like a dark.
Oh, yeah,
red,
yeah.
Like brownish, yeah.
I looked at it.
There's anything to that, too. I might reveal more later.
I don't know.
I hope not. Because you don't need, I mean, I'm kind of 50-50 when it comes to like teasers and stuff like that. Is it giving too much away? Yeah.
I like the poster for Nope. I thought that was cool. That showed me kind of basically what I was sort of expecting.
That was like one of my favorite in the past like 10 years. Yeah. I loved it because what it was just a cloud that looked like a spaceship with like the, what do they call those? Car sales flags just hanging out.
Pennants? Do you call those pennants?
Yeah, I think
yeah. Yeah, yeah, something like that. But that was very cool. Yeah, absolutely. So it got me intrigued.
Well, let me ask you guys something. Do you think it's like too early to be teasing something 2.5 years out? For God's sake. I feel like, you know, you're not going to like, you don't want to build any momentum because then it'll burn out before your movie even comes out.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's too early because I think we're all fans of Jordan Peele. You know, we've all enjoyed all three of his movies that he's released. And, you know, it's like eating your favorite
dessert.
He's
just giving us the tip right now. You know what I mean?
Well, I wasn't going to go there. I was going to be like that dessert that you love, but you know, you can't have it all the time. But you get like, when you start thinking about it, it's like, yeah, I want that cheesecake or pie,
no, ice
whatever.
Cream. It's ice cream.
I guess. I do enjoy a little cheesecake, and I do enjoy a game of Just the Tip, so I guess I'll just wait.
Whoa.
That's a cheesy cake tip.
So, like, it is a long ways off, but also it's Jordan Peele, so I think I'm wondering, like, what else does he have planned maybe that he's going to tease with? So, and if he's teasing this early, I'm really wondering, like, why? Because he hasn't done that with the other films, so.
Right.
I'm kind of curious what he's at, so I don't know.
I am, too. It's got me intrigued to see if he brings back his like normal cast of characters or normal actors as different characters, you know, like Daniel Kaluuya. I mean, I'd be stoked to see him in another Jordan Peele movie.
Yeah. I'd be stoked to see Lupita Nyong'o or Kiki Palmer.
I was just going to say, give me more Kiki.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. She was great. She was great.
Same. Yeah. Well, okay. I see your point, John. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't.
Properly teased.
Yes. He did his job. So thank you, Jordan Peele. We appreciate you. Anytime you want to come on A Cut Above, you're more than welcome. You got our number.
He's definitely listening right now.
You know he is. Okay, so we watched that trailer from M. Night Shyamalan. It must have been a couple months ago now. The movie Trap. It was supposed to come out the middle of August. It's actually been moved up to August 2nd.
Okay.
I'm wondering if it's gotten really good test audiences, which is why it's being moved up.
Yeah, moved earlier can be, that doesn't happen so often. Moved later is usually earlier. I'm like,
I'm curious about that one. I'm curious if my theory is correct too. So.
I think what you talked about, I think that's like right on the nose. However, it's M. Night and could be another twist.
Or it just could be a twist that we can kind of see coming.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, when we talked about that trailer, I feel like M. Night Shyamalan's whole career is like a trap for me. Like I keep getting trapped into watching these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I'm disappointed, but once in a while I'm not. And that's the trap is like once in a while they really hit for me. And that's what keeps me coming back, even though like, you know, the batting average is not high.
I've heard mixed things about The Watchers.
I haven't watched that yet.
Some people told me they liked it. Some people hated it. So I don't know.
Watchers?
Yeah.
It's in the theater right now.
No.
Yeah, it's in the theater.
Is that his daughter? No.
No, no. It's Michael Monroe. Oh, maybe it's, I don't know. Shyamalan's name is attached to it.
No, Michael Monroe is in Watcher. That's different than The Watchers.
Okay. No, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, Michael Monroe.
In both?
Is she? That would be sort of a
She's the main character in The Watchers.
Oh, well, I didn't know.
The girl against the glass in the trailer.
Well, then I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I stand.
And she's in The Watcher, yes.
I'm sorry. I thought you were getting
confused.
Oh,
no, it's Dakota Fanning.
Oh, the director. Oh, no. John, you're right. The director is Ishana Knight Shyamalan.
Yeah, his daughter, right?
Nice.
Okay. Well, we're getting all cleared up here.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so speaking of daughters. And it doesn't have what's her name in it. Yeah.
We don't know what we're talking about.
We don't.
We're
we
not
lost our
above.
No, we all lost our horror cards.
No, because we're talking about Shyamalan, so who really fucking cares?
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, hon.
I did like the segue. I did like the segue into daughters because another icon of horror, George Romero's daughter Tina, is taken after dear old dad.
Ooh, okay.
She's got her debut feature length film called Queens of the Dead, expected to be released in 2025.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
No other, there's no plot or anything like that, but Queens of the Dead.
Okay. Oh. Interesting. I'll give it a try. I'm into nepotism.
Well, if it's good, then...
Depending on the family, sure.
A Nepo baby.
Nepo baby. Well, I mean, Baby Berg has done pretty well, you know, forging his own career after Daddy Berg, Cronenberg,
I'm still waiting on a check from those guys. Being their cousin and all.
I know. They owe you royalties, I think.
Yeah.
But that's all I have.
Crimsonberg.
Okay. Crimsonberg. Oh my God. Can you Photoshop that movie poster so that it's the same font but it says Crimsonberg instead of Crimson Peak?
Hmm. We need we need Wesley.
Yeah. I'm no good at Photoshop.
Miles.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah.
All me
right.
Either. So that's all I got. So anyways, Jacqueline, this is your pick this week. You picked from 2015, Crimson Peak. Why, why did you choose this movie?
Well, I, for a while now, have just been kind of in the mood for sort of a big scale, like sort of classic, but modern gothic. I've just been craving something gothic. You know what I mean? I wanted something like, I wanted to watch like a pretty movie. And so I saw this movie in the theater when it first came out, and I really enjoyed it, and I bought it on Blu-ray, and I have not watched it since. I thought, you know, this is a movie I'd really like to rewatch. I remember enjoying it a whole lot. I'm pretty sure it has that vibe I'm looking for right now. I just wanted to watch something like with some nice production value. I wanted to watch something pretty, and I was sort of in a gothy sort of mood. So I thought this probably fits the bill, and that's why I picked it. It's just one of those I've wanted to cover.
So what you're saying is that gothy Jacqueline came out.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
She put on her pink robe.
I put on a pink bathrobe.
But you got to see her eye makeup. She's wearing black lipstick.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
That's my vibe, man.
Yeah, she's already bathed in the virgin blood.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Listen, I play the part of a respectable, you know, pink-robed middle
aristocrat.
Class. I don't know about aristocrat. I want to see my makeup, but...
I'm kidding.
But on the side, I'm still the same goth girl I was in high school, in my heart. So
nice. Excellent.
Anyway, so
I respect that. So, Jacqueline, would you like to kick us off to tell us whether this movie fucks or sucks?
I'd love to.
Thank you.
As I said, this movie really brings out my inner high school goth girl. You know, there are different flavors of goth, you know, and for me, the kind of flavor that I most connect with is the sort of like turn of the century, Victorian Edwardian black lace dresses and you know, that kind of like aesthetic with the gothiness. And so to me, this movie is a beautiful, glorious, blood-soaked fuck.
That's damn. It. Whoa.
Yep.
Dang.
John.
That's a lot yes. of blood.
Soju over at Straight Chillin' has joked in the past about starting like a goth sex cult or something. And I feel like this would be the like the official movie. Yeah, this would be like the official movie of the goth sex.
So. Yeah, if you don't like this movie, you're fucking out of here, bro.
Yeah.
No orgies for you. No blood orgies.
Cult, yeah. So, John, what
yes.
about this movie? Does Crimson Peak fuck or suck?
Honestly, Jacqueline, it's one of the few pieces of physical media that I actually have. I've got the Blu-ray version. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I saw it, I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. But on this watch, this movie ain't for me. There's a lot of beauty in it. There's a lot of just wonderful things about it. But it just, it's hard to explain that it's not me. It's not for me. So to be fair, I love Guillermo del Toro. It's not going to put a damper on the way I feel about him as a director. I think he's fantastic. All the acting was great. I can't explain why it didn't hit for me this time. So I'm going to give this, just kind of a flaccid fuck, semi-entertaining, but not memorable for me.
That's fair. I don't judge you for that. I feel like this is a particular taste, and I don't think it's necessarily everybody's taste. So I don't judge you for that one bit. But thanks for that honest assessment.
You bet.
Hydraberg, what do you think?
It's Baronetberg.
I'm sorry. Baronetberg. Does Crimson fuck or suck?
Yeah. Like the first night in a haunted mansion that sinks deeper and deeper into the soft clay, with the echoes of past lovers roaming the halls. This is a hot topic of a fuck.
Wow.
I love you for saying that. Oh, Lord. So I'm looking at the poster art, which you have as your background, Hydraberg, and it's making me think about something. You know, the sort of gothy, like the kind of romantic gothic flavor is kind of my favorite flavor of gothiness. And I think for me, it actually goes back to my childhood. This sounds corny, but I feel like it does kind of explain a lot about me. My favorite ride at Disney growing up, I grew up in Orlando. My favorite ride at Disney was always the Haunted Mansion. And every time I went on that ride, again, this sounds stupid because it's just a theme park ride, but I really do feel like it kind of formed something in my psyche. I would pretend that I lived in the house, and I would wish desperately that someday I could live in the Haunted Mansion. Like that would be my ideal, like that would be my dream house. Right. And I would like fantasize about how cool it would be to live there. Now, the one in the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland in California is themed different from the one in Orlando. The one in California is meant to look like a New Orleans. It's like it's in New Orleans. But the one in Orlando, which I went to all the time, it's like a Victorian style, like turn of the century mansion. And so that is like the aesthetic that I was like soaking up. And it like there's a part in the ride when you go through like the library, and the narrator of the ride is like, "Welcome to our ghostly library with, you know, thousands of volumes of only ghost stories, of course." And as a child, that really sparked my imagination. That was like, oh, I could like, you know, I wasn't like well-versed as a child in like horror literature, obviously. But in my mind, that sparked my imagination to think like, oh, that's a thing I could dive into. Like I could just read ghost stories if I wanted to. I could just explore horror literature. And it sort of like sparked this concept in me that like that is a thing. Like that's something I could make my thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's not just a thing that like, it doesn't have to just be something you engage in once in a while. Like that can be a thing that you get into. Does that make any sense to you guys?
Yeah,
totally. Jacqueline, and I'm going to add to your story a little bit because I am from San Diego. I've been to Disneyland and Anaheim plenty of times. And right. like you, my favorite ride at Disneyland was the Haunted Mansion.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, I must have been six. I must have already seen Halloween and went through that whole little thing. But the like the horror of it and, you know, just the ride. You sit in these bucket
seats.
What does
it love like a spooky castle, spooky mansion sort of vibe?
It kind of does, but Jacqueline's right. It's got more of that New Orleans type, almost French Quarter type look for the one in Anaheim. And I've never been to Disney World, so it's like that's my comparison. But I loved it. I mean, the way the room stretched out.
Yes.
You know, at the end of the ride, you got ghosts sitting next to you, and while you're looking in the mirror, and you're like, "What the fuck is that?"
That was so exciting to me. Like, my imagination was so excited by that. Like, just imagining that, like, oh, I got like a pet ghost now that's going to come home with me. You know?
Exactly.
Cool. So you get it, John. But so,
I do. Again, I do.
It sounds corny because it's just like a theme park ride, right? But like, I think it influenced that kind of affinity that I have for that gothic flavor. So, and my affinity for horror literature and ghost stories and things like that. So I don't know. I think there's a link there as to like why this sort of thing hits for me.
Yeah. Understood.
All right. Well, so now that we got all the origin story out of the way, John, you want to hit us with that spoiler warning so we can get into it?
You bet I will. We're going to be talking about Crimson Peak from 2015. If you have not seen this movie, pause the podcast. Go watch it, then come back to find out what we thought about it.
All right, cool. Hydra Berg, have you got a reach around plot summary for us?
I do. I have a gothically romantic reach around for you guys.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm in my robe already.
It's draped in velvet.
What is that, velvet?
Beautiful. Ready? Yep.
Ready, guys? A little girl who lost her mother, warning of a distant lover. A ghostly shape above her hovers. Now flash ahead many years. The little girl, she lost her fears. The most astute considered peers. Into her life two siblings enter. Thomas Sharp, an odd inventor. A dealer and presenter, his affections he center. Thomas and Edith with candle waltz. Her father distrusting it not his fault. In the bath there is an assault. Mr. Cushing takes a deadly fall. Edith married onto Allerdale Hall. The ghostly warning she can't recall. Don't look for me inside the past. Apparitions come, their deaths they cast. Haunting Edith, she quite aghast. As Alan tries to piece things together, Edith lies, her husband beds her. She comes across an older letter. She can't hold back her abject terror. Sharp's contraption on Earth's clay the brightest red. His other wives lie among us dead. A cleaver sunk into his mother's head. Also he and his sister could have the best. Hide away sibling incest. Such tall tales Edith suggests. Now hush up and drink your tea, and never mind this set of keys. A secret brings this family to its knees. Alan's dead, but he'll survive. Sharp has had him several wives. Her brother's love, her cherished prize. Lucille revealed to be the villain. A house of murder in clay it sinks in. Its victims perish, now red their skin. Edith, though, she hears their calls. Their spirits roam this mansion's halls. As siblings love, it wanes and falls. Blood and love, they both run deep. Its caverns steep with secrets keep. Beware, beware of Crimson Peak.
Yeah.
I love that one so much. It's so good. Nicely done.
Thank you.
Very poetic, I think.
Well, this movie, there is a poetry to this film.
Okay, guys, tell me if I'm wrong, and I'm not familiar with Hammer films, but this has got like a mix of, like you said, Jacqueline, like gothic, almost a Hammer style.
Yeah, I could see that.
And maybe even a little giallo with the use of color.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. I think some of the use of the bright colors, like the reds and blues. And also we have a kill scene early on with like a black glove, and you don't know the killer's identity until the end. You do find out at the end who it is, but there's that kind of mystery throughout. So I definitely think there's a little tinge of giallo in there. I also see quite a few literary influences here. I definitely see The Haunting of Hill House with, the house somewhat portraying like an externalization of one of the characters, like inner
psyche. A little
psyche.
Dorian Gray, if you will, too.
Yeah, Dorian Gray. I also see some Shining there. Mm. I see a lot of Rebecca. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Rebecca. There have been two movies. It's a book, but there have been two movies made of it. just in a sentence, it's about like a young wife who marries this older man, and he has been previously married and now widowed, and she's sort of haunted by the memory of that former wife. Like everybody in the house, he takes her to his like beautiful estate, and all the servants and everything are like, they keep talking about the first wife and they don't accept the new wife, and she kind of is like going mad. There's kind of this like ever-present specter of the first wife. So I see a lot of that there. But yeah, a lot of literary influences, a lot of the kind of gothic tropes that we come to expect from like a haunted house movie or a Hammer movie. But I think there's some subversions too. There's some modernizations as well, which we can get later.
There are. This movie is a love letter to a lot of those things, for sure, for Guillermo. Mm-hmm. You can see it.
Yeah.
I like the opening, like the child's voice singing, and the Universal logo just bathed in red right off the bat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the mix of sound. We start getting this like heavy breathing almost, and then almost like a locomotive type sound. We don't know what it is. It's that apparatus.
Yeah.
Later, but
well, like I said, with me, it is that there were so many good things about this, but it just didn't hit. You
it's
know,
not your flavor of, but it's you really acknowledge not. That it's like it looks beautiful, it sounds good, like it's acted well. Yeah, it's
just
it,
and you and Heidelberg, you brought up The Shining, right? So Jesus, to me, I can recognize that that's a classic movie. However, it's not for me. It's not like I don't put it in my top 10. You know, when it comes to horror movies, I just, this like felt very similar, even though it's a different time, but it's got that same kind of beautifulness to the you know, the direction, the sound design, the colors, you know, the aesthetic of the movie is wonderful. I love when they first get to the castle and it's just, they've got that hole in the roof. And it's just snowing, and there's that beautiful shot of just like snow or something falling on the ground, you know.
It's kind of that beautiful decay, right?
Like
crumbling, and yet it's beautiful at the same time.
Yep.
Just like there's a beautiful brutality to the violence.
Yeah.
Yeah. So John, what you said actually makes perfect sense, and I didn't make that connection, even though I was thinking about The Shining while watching this, but I forgot that that's not your flavor either. So it makes perfect sense that this wouldn't really do it for you either. So I get that.
This movie oozes style. I mean, the set literally is oozing.
Literally oozes.
Like,
yeah.
But it really does. Like just the introduction, the younger Edith, and like that first apparition, her mother there comes to her, and just the way it's shot over the shoulder. The long hallways and like the casting of shadow play on everything, and the way, I don't know, it kind of hides some of the CGI that has aged decently still. It looks all right. But there's just something to it. I think it looks great, like right off the bat.
I agree with you. So I don't want to get like too focused on like the part of the film after they go to the castle. Like I do, but I don't want to overlook the first act of the film.
I like the first act too.
Yeah, like I'm glad you're talking about that, because I really like the part, you know, how we start the story in Buffalo with Edith, played by Mia Wasikowska, who I really like. I haven't seen her in a whole lot of things, but the couple of things I've seen her in, I did enjoy her performances. I don't know about you guys, but while I was watching her giving this performance as this very like intellectual but also like fashionable and lovely young woman, I couldn't help but think of Nicole the whole time. This would be like Nicole at the turn of the 20th century. I don't know if you guys kind of got any of that flavor too, but I was like, I think of her as so intelligent and like, but also pretty and fashionable and beautiful, and just, I don't know, there's like a Nicole vibe for me just watching Mia Sikowska in this role.
I loved her in this. I thought she did a bang up job. I you know, with this kind of role, it almost fits her perfectly, because she does have that, she carries herself like a very proper, intelligent, beautiful young woman that, you know, just really got her way through this time period of like, you know, she does come from money, but she's also like almost humble a little bit.
Well, she's proving her own. Like, I love that moment where her dad gives her the pen.
Yeah.
Which is a cool gift. And he's like glaring at it, because she's like, no, the pen's great and all, but I don't want to write it, because they'll know that it's coming from a woman. I want to use your dingy typewriter or whatever. Like, that's what I want to use. And I almost wondered if the pen was like he was actually trying to kind of subdue her a little bit with the pen, or was he encouraging? I couldn't tell. Or like he was just like looking at the fact that she got a gift that he thought she was going to get real excited about, and she kind of put it down, you know, kids.
Yeah.
Do.
That's like a little bit of a painful moment, but I read it as him trying to encourage her, but just not thinking of the obstacle that she faces as a female writer, where she has to disguise her identity as a woman. And so what I think, one of the things I think is interesting about this first act is that at the very, very beginning, you know, her voiceover introduces the idea that there are going to be ghosts in this story. You know, she says like, the ghosts are real, this I know. And, you know, we find out about her mother and we see her mother visiting her, but then it shifts gears for a while and the story becomes about her aspirations to become a successful writer. And
writing a ghost story, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like we kind of forget
for the story
about ghosts. Yeah, but exactly. She telegraphs some things that we need to know for this story. Mm. She's like, you know, ghosts are a metaphor for the past, which we come to see how that applies to this story. And also she has a little line about like, well, it's not so much a ghost story as a story with a ghost in it. And I think that might be how like Guillermo del Toro wants us to see this film.
Because the editor's like, it needs a little romance, which we get in this film as well.
She's sort of reluctant to put that in there, but this movie really does turn out to be a very like gothic romance. Mm. It's not all horror all the time. It's very much a romance as well. But I like that we get to see a little bit of her story and some of the challenges that she comes up against in trying to become a successful writer as a woman. And then this sort of, you know, I don't know if I want to go so far as to call it a love triangle, but the doctor seems interested in her.
Oh, yeah,
but
totally.
She, you know, her eye is sort of caught by this newcomer and there's like this little intrigue.
I'm glad they don't play on that too much, though. You can tell automatically, they set it up. You could tell that the dad, Mr. Cushing, looks at him like, you're the son-in-law I would really love my daughter to be with. You know what I mean? But, yeah. So that's enough.
Well, he's a doctor, right?
He's close with the family. Like, yeah.
Well, and Tom Hiddleston, you know, he plays that tall, dark, and handsome, mysterious, you know? So she's definitely intrigued by him. I want to go back
to see his butt later.
Yes, you do. I wonder if that was really his butt, though.
It looked, I think so.
I don't know. It looked a little muscular than I would expect.
You think that was a stunt butt? If that was Tom Atkins, that would have been.
Hold on a second. This is right around the time he's playing Loki in the Marvel movies. Okay. So he's probably in great shape, you know.
But he's not allowed to show his butt because he's in Disney films. So he's got to go stunt butt.
Yeah, that's true. That's possible. I want to go back to the dad. I think the dad's character chewed up every scene he was in. He was so good. I mean, it was just like, he was actually, you know, just stern, but loving, right?
He knew what he was talking about. He knew a man's character. Like, he could tell that, you know what I mean? He was knowledgeable.
I feel like the movie telegraphs to us that the father is a character we should trust. You know, he expresses some suspicions of this newcomer, and we don't really have anything concrete upon which to judge Thomas Sharp on yet, but I think that we've sort of come to trust the father. We've seen that he cares for his daughter and he's encouraging her career, even though it's somewhat unorthodox for the time for a woman. And so I think we come to trust him. And so if he's suspicious, I think that telegraphs to us that we're supposed to be suspicious. Yeah. Even though we don't quite know why yet.
Especially, you know, when we meet Lucille, like when it starts getting like, okay, something's going on here.
She's
Jacqueline. I kind of want to piggyback off what you're saying, because it's like you're a parent, Joey's a parent. You have that intuition about your kids of, you know, you don't want to be around this person or you don't want to be in this situation. So that's real life. You know, I think all of our parents had it at some point, or it's just like, you have to don't go in this situation.
Right. But then also, you know, it's a tale as old as time, right? Like, as a parent, you really can't like force your children to do what you want them to do. And especially if they're grown, they're going to make their own mistakes and what they want to do, regardless of your advice. You know, 9 times out of 10, they're going to do it their way and they'll learn. But as a parent, you want to try to save them from learning the hard way, you know, but here we go, you know, I'm trying to say Lucille. Edith goes ahead and marries the guy, you know, after her father's death. She does go ahead and marry the guy.
You rush that part of the movie a little bit for me.
The marriage?
Yeah, just the courting and the marriage. Like, it goes a little fast. And the film does sort of, that is sort of the film's crux. So like, it's sort of like, it's a gothic love story. So I feel like I would be more into it a little bit. Because to be honest, some of the melodrama, John, does bore me a little bit in this film. Because this film is 2 hours long. But it's not horrible. Like, the pacing's still pretty good. There's some cool stuff happening too. And I like the intrigue. But I do admit that, like, I don't know. If they had got me in more on their relationship, if it was just, I guess there's like a little bit of like a play sort of vibe to this where they're acting, you know what I mean? Almost like a stage play a little bit because of that storybook kind of vibe to Leaf's, you know, a gothic novel.
Much is a storybook. You're right. Don't they even show a book opening at the beginning?
Yeah, well, that's the book she ends up writing, which I do like that.
And so you're absolutely right. I guess for me, I felt like they established well enough that there's this like sort of sexual tension between them and that she's very intrigued with him and that we know that he's trying to pull something over on her, but still there's like a chemistry between them. And then so this is me applying my personal experience to the movie, which is, you know, may not at all be what Guillermo intended. But so I was married once before I was married to Joey. And at the time there were so many red flags before I got married that were telling me like, don't marry this person. But during that time, my father passed away and it was so devastating to me. And I felt very unmoored, like in life, like sort of adrift in life. And I felt like a strong need to like be anchored somehow. I felt like directionless and confused in life. And so despite some warnings from loved ones in my life, I went ahead and married this person. probably not completely in my right mind. I was grieving a lot at the time, but for me, it was like a way to clutch at a sense of stability and anchoring and family. And so I almost feel like, you know, she's already kind of infatuated with this person. She suffers a terrible trauma with the death of her father. And I think I interpret it as possibly there was a desire to clutch at something. No, you know,
I think you're absolutely right, actually. When you paint it like that, for sure. I just think they speed over it a little bit for me. Just, I don't know. I don't mind that part of the story.
That sometimes happens in, like, gothic novels. It's just that, like, people... So, like, in, you know, I was mentioning Rebecca before, you know, with the young woman goes home with the widower and he's already been married, but she's kind of, like, adapting to his life now. So in that book, I'm pretty sure they met and kind of dated or whatever for like a week and then just like suddenly got married.
I couldn't tell sometimes if it's a time frame or if it's just a tropey thing where they have like, you know, the girl who doesn't know better back then, like just marries a guy in like a week or two or how much time went by.
Stories. I think that happens a lot.
Yeah.
Actually. So, and just like, and you know, and then you cut to, and then they were married and he's bringing home the new wife.
In the castle, which I love the reveal of Allerdale.
Oh my God. I mean, I'm hard pressed to think of a better like horror set other than maybe The Shining.
Did you notice the contrast in color? So we start the movie, we get the color in her bedroom, like with the green on the wall and stuff like that. We get that kind of blend. Then we go back to the present and it's like desaturated, but golden when we're at like where she lives, you know, when Tom's character. And then when we go back to Adderall, that's when we inject more color to the movie again. Like the outside, and there's like you see the leaves blowing in the background. They're like green, but it's like shadowed color. Cause then we go inside, there's like contrast. I just love that about this film. This film's gorgeous.
That's cool. To be honest, I didn't really notice the color palette in the film before they went to Allerdale.
Desaturated, but goldeny. Like all the paper and all their tan, like the way what's his name's hair looked. The Charlie Hunnam's character, he was like bathed in gold and all.
McMichael says his name, Dr. McMichael.
Alan McMichaels.
I'll tell you, Charlie Hunnam, like he was so out of character in this. I guess because I had watched Sons of Anarchy, and it's just he was able to use his real accent, and it was just it was baffling because he was like he played like almost the I'd say like damsel in distress, but that's the
role
he's.
John, that's exactly what Guillermo del Toro told him when he
Oh, like
he
when he
gave him
gets
the script
stabbed.
in the
Yeah.
damsel in distress character. That's so funny that you said that. Yeah, that's exactly what he.
Because it, like, and it's not typecasting for him because he play. If you've ever seen Sons of Anarchy, you know he plays the tough guy. He's the badass motorcycle, the new leader or whatever. But in this movie, it's completely opposite. He's intellectual. He doesn't seem very tough. He's,
It's
but
gentle.
yeah, he's smart.
So I'll be honest, I like his character, and I don't think he does a horrible job, but I just don't love Charlie Dunham. I don't know what it is.
Dunham.
What's that? I'm sorry.
Dunham.
Hunnam. Yeah, sorry.
I don't think anything else. So this is really my only exposure to him.
But he's perfectly fine in this. Like he's not like I don't mean that to be like horrible. I'm just like, I don't know.
No. I mean, it's not the most interesting role in the
No.
world. So, you know.
But I do like his character, and I like what they do with him. I do like that he shows up, and there's an interesting, I don't know, relationship between him and Thomas, because when we get to see that Thomas isn't really all in on all this, even though it seems like he is from the beginning, but I don't know. We find out that he's like definitely reluctant to keep murdering people because we find out he hasn't been the one doing it, and so.
Yeah, that's the conversation I'd like to have a
You
little bit
prefer if
later.
he was, him and the sister were just plotting the whole fucking time, right? Like both evil, kind of.
Well, no, I don't like the term. I mean, I guess we can skip to the end. I do not appreciate the turnaround. This isn't a criticism of the script. It's a criticism of the character himself, like as a person. I don't like how he, you know, has been part of this plot for who knows how many years, and has, even if he hasn't physically done the murdering of these his mother and the previous wives, he's been in on it.
Yeah, he's complicit.
Absolutely. I mean, just because he didn't do it, I mean,
Gotta hide the bodies.
I think he's just as guilty as Lucille. I don't like how he has this turn on. He's like, oh, well, you're different. I really love you. And it's like, dude, it is way too late. You are fucking sick.
They're gaslighting her like the whole time.
Big time.
Totally. It's just like that is unforgivable. And I forgot, like, I didn't really remember all the details of the story from when it first came out. So watching it this week was very much like, it was very much like watching it for the first time. I didn't remember how the story turned out. And so I was like, God help me. If she falls for his bullshit and like gets back with him, I'm gonna lose it. And I'm so glad that she didn't. Because it's just like, I don't know. It's just, he's such a pathetic character to me that, like, I get why he's intriguing, but he's like murdering all his wives for money, and I just don't accept that he
And what are you doing with that money? You're just sinking it into this clay business? Like, I don't understand.
it into this invention of his, which is like just
Why?
confusion. It's not taking off.
Why is
Like,
Lucille like okay with that though? She seems rational at least in a
I think it,
sense.
well, she's not, I
Even though
think
she's insane.
the only thing they have to hang their hopes on. They have no other form of income. Like, this machine
Sell
has
your
to.
fucking land and move away. That's what they should have done. Kill a
Yeah.
couple people and
Who's
then leave.
your land with the clay oozing everywhere? Like, I feel like that's kind of a tough sell. So I feel like the two of them are really hanging all their hopes for the future on the success of this machine, and hence their desperation for money. But I just don't appreciate how he, oh, he really loves this one. You know, it just, it
Yeah,
kind of
she's
smacks of,
different,
yeah,
but she's smart.
it smacks of this thing that some men do where they're like, you're different from other girls. And it's like, it's a way of like trying to compliment a woman by putting down all other women. And it kind of
We just
feels
want you
like,
to tell us that we're different too. That's what we want you to do.
well,
No, I'm just kidding.
go to therapy.
I need a hug.
Well, it's a
Yeah.
certain level, like you said, gaslighting, you know.
Yeah.
It's it, that's exactly
It is a
what he's
tactic.
doing, you know. Can I bring up Jessica Chastain? Because
Please do.
I think she's one of the most underappreciated actors of our time. I mean, she's so versatile in everything that she does, and so,
She's so good in this.
dude, yeah. I mean, Jessica Chastain was fantastic in this movie. You know, I was talking about the dad in the first act of really chewing up all the scenes that he was in, and you really got charmed by him. You get charmed by her, and then you hate her, and you're
Yeah, her
like,
introduction on the piano.
Oh, hell yeah, dude.
You're like, who is this woman?
Yeah.
So to me, she's the most interesting character in the story. And she actually, Del Toro initially wanted her for the role of Edith. But when she read the script, she was like, oh, please, can I be Lucille instead? Mm. And I think that's absolutely the right call.
Yeah, because that's more fun.
I'm surprised that Del Toro considered her for the role of Edith to begin with.
I'm not. I think she would have killed it in that role.
Yeah, but you mean like someone a little bit more meek or seeming, or like you think Chastain maybe can't pull that off as much?
Jessica Chastain has always struck me as a very like strong and confident, powerful woman.
Yeah.
Like even just her face, like she has very strong features and I don't know, she has a bold look to her.
There's a confidence about her too.
Yeah. And like no insult to Mia Wasikowska. I think she's a little bit smaller framed. Her looks are not as like bold. Like she has kind of a pale blonde hair, pale skin, and you know, she's kind of, her makeup and hair are done very sort of like modestly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Whereas Jessica Chastain's look is, she has like the dark hair and the red lips and the
her big scarring blood. Starts coming out as the film progresses, I notice. Because you don't see it at first, like on her lip, and then it's, but you could see it by her eye on Chastain's character.
Yeah.
So something interesting on the Blu-ray is that Jessica has second billing to Mia in this movie.
Good. I think that's right.
Because her turn at the end is just some of the best parts of the movie, I thought.
I completely agree. I mean, she becomes more and more menacing. I mean, she's sinister from the start, but I mean, she becomes increasingly...
When they sleep together.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that she really kind of loses her mind further.
Some nice looking soup, too. What was that? Pasta fagioli? Look like a little pasta fagioli, you know what I'm saying?
We need a Crimson Peak cookbook.
Yeah, that was probably Guillermo del Toro's recipe of pasta fagioli.
He's Mexican.
He is Mexican.
Mexicans can cook Italian. We know that. I've eaten at Italian restaurants.
For the cooks at
home. Yeah. Jacqueline, it would have been menudo, right?
Yeah, menudo or pozole.
Yeah, pozole. There you go.
Yeah, pozole. Oh, I love some pozole. Anyway. But yeah, so I think it's correct that she gets second billing to Mia because I like how the story comes down to a battle between
it's
the two.
It's a female-centric film. I mean, all the victims were female. They're coming. They're trying to warn Edith of what's going on. Her mother was trying to warn her. You know what I mean? It really does focus on the women, honestly. And Hiddleston's character is the main male that's involved in that.
Yeah, way. But he's sort of incidental. I feel like very
that's
much
I
it's
mean,
a,
yeah.
between the wills of the two women. Mm-hmm. And I love the showdown between them at the end, because here's one of the things that I think this movie subverts in terms of like the gothic tropes. Mia, Edith's character is, she's sick because she's being poisoned by Lucille. She's sick, but she is not weak. And despite her being slowly poisoned and being ill, she fights hard. She's not like a weakling who's fainting on the couch every second, you know, like these scary things, and she faces them. She is confronted with real physical danger and she fights. You know what I mean? Like, she doesn't just like faint or run away screaming. Like, she is confronting.
You see the man that raised her too, you know what I mean? Like, you could tell that's some of that.
And this is a man who's teaching her to be strong. You know, he's not telling her at the beginning, oh, you can't be a writer. He's like, you fucking do it. You know, he doesn't say it like that, but
he gives her the pen.
So I think you're right. I think she learned a lot of strength from her father and was raised to be strong, and we see that come out. And I feel like that's not always typical of a gothic heroine. Sometimes, but oftentimes,
I think that's why Chastain is better as the villainess, because we get to see the growth of Mia's character. Better.
And then you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to touch on too, which is that the ghosts in this movie, they're scary. Like,
they're cool looking though.
Fucking scary, but they're also not trying to frighten her. They're trying to help her.
They're sending her messages.
They're trying to show her.
That almost gives her the strength to overcome everything, because she's the one victim that won't succumb, because she can see the other victims. She can hear from them, and it's almost given her strength to, like, she now knows what's going on.
Yeah, she's benefiting from their experience. Yeah. And because of her character, she might have like more of an ability to be able to sense the presence of ghosts, whereas like maybe not everybody can, like
her imagination or something.
Yeah, she's sensitive. She's imaginative. She's writing a ghost story. Maybe something about having, you know, a mother who passed away. I don't know, but
that was the first ghost she said she saw.
Right, and so she's able to perceive these warnings and make them work to her benefit. Like she benefits from them, and it helps life. And so I think that's another difference.
I love all the ghost stuff.
Yeah. You mentioned CGI earlier. I gotta be honest, that's one of the things I don't love about this. I know that the ghosts were done like as practically as they could.
They are.
But there are moments where I don't think it looks great.
They look like I like some of it for a good bit.
I was gonna bring that up as one of my knocks was the CGI.
It's like, you know, when they come out of the floor and stuff, that looks weird. Right?
Yeah, it didn't hold up for me. You know, this movie's almost 10 years old. But yeah, the CGI to me just really didn't hold up. It just felt like there was maybe a little bit too much of it. I don't know. I think the castle looked really good. It almost seemed like it was real. You know, a lot of the set pieces were real, but like with the ghosts and stuff, they were frightening looking and very, very menacing. But yeah, it just didn't hold up for me.
I loved a good bit of them, but yeah, they don't all hold up. But I do like their looks. And I like that you can see that, like, oh, these are not the same person. Like, you start noticing, like, there's different ghosts.
Right, right. I like that, too.
They have different means of talking to her as well. I mean, there's details in the ghost too. You see the ring finger on one of them cut off. Why? Because it had the ring on it that Chastain's character is going to take back no matter what. It's her birthright. You know what I mean? Like, and then you always see like the type of death displayed.
Yeah. And so, well, you know, I have a hard time criticizing a movie for the CGI effects, because you can only do what you're able to do at the time. You know, like, it's not fair to criticize a movie for the effects that they used at the time, because that's what they had available to them. But I do feel a need to comment that I don't think it looks great at certain moments.
I think it's a look that he's going for, like that wispy, ghosty sort of, it almost has a cartoon vibe to it a little bit, like scary cartoon.
That's what I don't like. I like the wispiness. I like the transparency.
Yeah.
But some of the movement seems a little jerky, and there
I like
is
some of the herky jerky, like the doorknob, that stuff I like.
Well, that's
yeah, because you don't
like
see
the
ghost.
Movement of ghosts themselves, and there are moments where it verges on cartoony looking, and I don't care for that. So I think Del Toro, you know, tried to do it as practically as he could. Like, there were actors, you know, in suits that
like
were
the
like
closet one.
Yeah, but
I think there's a decent blend or a melange, if you will.
And you will.
Well done.
So I can't make it a major knock on the movie because it's not the movie's fault, but I can comment on it and just, you know, that I don't love it.
But yeah. I will say that even movies nowadays, like even in 2024, they overuse CGI just like a motherfucker. And you're just like, seriously, you really had to do this? You couldn't do it practically?
It was a critique, you know? When this came out. Like, it's not just now, 10 years later. Like, people were talking about the CGI when it first came out, too. Just like, oh, why'd you do some, you know, and just that natural knee-jerk reaction people have right away of like, oh, you went CGI? You should have went practical.
So I like the mother, when we see the ghost of the mother. Yeah. And I also like the ghost of Thomas when we see him at the end. I think that looks very good. I like the mother in the bathtub.
Chastain's ghost looks pretty cool at the end.
She looks good because it doesn't look cartoony. It looks like
part of the skull,
like a decayed version of her, you know. But they're like the ghosts in the hallway, like who show her the closet with the wax recordings. Sometimes those look kind of a little too eye bulgy, a little too cartoony.
Conjuring.
But not all of them. Like, some of them look very good to me, but just something I wanted to mention.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also, I mean, dependent on the state of decay, maybe, on the victims, you know, because some of them are like downstairs in the muck. And so those ones are like really, they're gross, don't even move good. They're like crawling on the floor. I don't know. But yeah, it is. And I know they're actors mostly, like portrayed and then blended in with CGI. Like most of it is an actor with something on, right? And then they're blending it in.
Doug Jones, actually.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Doug Jones from Ape Sapien and.
Yep, a lot of stuff. So yeah, Doug Jones was the, who was he? He was in the bathtub, and I think he was one of the other ghosts. I think it's in my trivia. I'll get to
him. He was the creature in Shape of Water.
You've never seen that? No, I need to.
Oh my god, that movie's good.
It won the Oscar, which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
Best picture. But anyway.
I have a funny story about that movie one day when you see it, about how I saw it in the theater.
Oh, okay.
But you know what I did love? I loved how Edith told off Mrs. McMichaels, who is that supposed to be, what's his name's mom?
Yeah,
Ellen. That is mom, because she looks like almost the same age, but yeah.
Yeah,
so when she talks about like, you're going to die like Jane Austen or whatever, like a spinster or whatever. And then I liked how she was like, no, I prefer Mary Shelley, right? A widow.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
she kind of glances at her son, like, you know what I mean? Like, maybe I'll marry your son. Who knows? Yeah. I'll do what I want. Yeah.
That was a great, like that moment. Great burn, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she gets the pen, which is mightier than the sword, we find out later.
It is. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I think there's a lot of good symbolism in this movie. We were talking before about the house and how the house, you could see the house as, you know, how it's decaying. It's beautiful, but it's decaying. You could almost see that as like an outward reflection of Lucille and how she's deteriorating. And then she really goes fucking apeshit.
You know? It's like inner, like it's moving in on itself. You know what I mean? Sinking.
It's doing that. And the deeper, outside deeper. Is the hole in the roof. Literally, like the outside is literally inside.
I want to like reiterate my compliment to that, because that looks so damn good. I mean, you saw the roof that was decayed, but there's just like this almost symmetrical shape on the floor, the way it's doing that.
Yeah,
I was really impressed.
And
by
the
that.
Different seasons, you know what I mean? That floor is different lighting will hit it, and leaves. I also, exactly. Mentioned the Haunted Mansion, and that's what this film is, except it's like a very adult version. So there's this weird dreamlike state or storybook sort of world to this vibe to this film, and then the romance and then the gothic nature, but then there's like this brutality to its violence that I really love. It's like gorgeously grotesque in this weird way, and it just, I don't know, the movie just really portrays violence, like her dad's death,
dude, my violence. Favorite.
Actually,
his face is caved in. Right?
Later. But they show it twice. They show it after it happens, and then they show
probably fell in even more.
Yeah, and they show like them identifying the body, and that was, oh my god, that was brutal.
Mm-hmm.
Heidelberg, I think that's one of the things I like most about this movie is that it is so beautiful in every aspect of its production design, and you sort of don't expect a movie that pretty to have like really brutal violence, but then it does. And for me, that is like a very enticing mixture. Yeah. I really like the beauty, but I also like the absolute grotesquery of it. And that's like, that really rings my bell.
Like the shots when Dunham gets, when Hunnam gets stabbed and he's like, you know, like, oh shit, I thought he was done for right there. Cause like Chastain doesn't fuck around. She went for the kill. And then he gets stabbed again, and there's that moment of him just like laying there with blood in the snow, and then the reveal, you know, the snow has been blown away and we're getting the crimson, you know, clay. It's just gorgeous. We pan out and we just see the whole like establishing shot of like the whole castle and everything going on. It's just, I don't know. The use of color in this movie is really cool, especially that crimson. It's everywhere. It's almost in every shot. You just may not notice it.
The crimson clay, when it looks like it's snowing or something like that, it's like, I thought that was beautiful. Like, it was just like, because it was red and you just see plots and shit like that.
Using down and, the tile.
Dude, oh my
in
God.
The kitchen.
So you guys know how, like, The Ring feels like a very wet movie? Like, there's a lot of wet environments in it. This movie feels like that, except it's that clay, but, and it looks like blood. And so it feels it feels like a really wet movie, and it feels like blood, even though we know it's not, but of course it's meant to evoke that image. And Heidelberg, you said, oh, the snow is blowing away and revealing the clay underneath. I don't think so. I actually think the clay is supposed to be soaking, the color of the clay is soaking.
Oh, soaking into the snow. Okay, yeah, that makes sense too. That's why the snow looks like it's going away. Yeah, because we see that too when his footsteps, we see those two footsteps that we focus on. Yeah, and then we see the clay start to come up through where he stepped. So yeah, that makes sense.
You know what that those scenes made me feel was cold. You know, just like this is cold. This is like you know, what you would imagine when they talk about people. What?
You're giving me the cold weather expert said he agrees. He
dude, he I lived in Wisconsin for that's four a big and deal. A half years.
So even though they use fake snow.
You can't see his breath.
Yeah, exactly. No, hold on. That would
I think you do see some breath when she comes into the house.
I think so too, but I love it. It invoked cold in me. Like I just I feel like when there are entities around, they talk about having cold spots or something like that. But this whole movie, that like the surrounding area of the castle was cold.
That might explain why the castle always is cold too, because it's filled with fucking ghosts.
And
a cave down below.
Yeah. There's ghosts and a hole in the roof.
This guy wasn't a villain, he could have been Batman back in the day. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that's the thing that's going on is like the inside is out in the house and the outside is in, and it's all cold. Mm-hmm. Like it's all, and it looks so windy, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not just cold, it's windy. And I mean, if you've been in cold weather, you know, like that makes it 10 times worse.
Yeah. You know who I love too? The guy that Cushing hires to get the dirt. That mm-hmm. actor, what is his name? It's like Gorman or something like that. Byrne Gorman. He's always like a shady, shadowy kind of guy in every role, and he's so good at it. I can't remember what other films I've seen him in. I think it was like Looper, maybe. I'm not positive. But he's always like a killer. He does a great little bit of acting in this, I thought, as the guy to dig up.
I don't recognize him from anything else, but I also enjoyed him in this film. It was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dark Knight. That's where I know him from.
Ah. All right. What else about the end should we discuss?
Oh. I do love the cat and mouse like run around of it all. When Chastain's just like, all right, it's all out in the open. And the shot of her giving him a little HJ there. Wow. I was like, okay. Hair down.
So I actually love I'm about to give you guys a really choice soundbite here. I really all right. love best in this movie. Because I feel like it's like I love having like a scandalous secret in a gothic story. And I mean, it could be any number of things, but I love that that's the big secret here. And like it's very salacious, you know, it's very scandalous. And I feel like the movie kind of misleads you for a minute when the digging up dirt guy is like, oh, he's already married. So and I feel like. You kind of think, oh, Lucille's not his sister, she's his wife, right? But then you find out that she's not his wife, she is his sister, but they are fucking, but he's been married to these other women in the past. And so I feel like, did you guys have that moment of being misled for a second too, where you're like, I mean, when it was your first time watching it, like, oh, Lucille's really his wife, she's Lady Sharp, but not because she's his sister, she's his wife. But then of course that's wrong.
Are we picking up flowers in the attic vibes maybe?
Yeah,
in the attic. I mean, that's where they were kept, right? That's where his tinkering little area is, right?
Never seen flowers maybe in the attic.
What,
all grown up,
you've never seen flowers in the attic?
Heidelberg, when are you gonna pick that movie?
I don't know, it's been on my list for a long time
since we started. It was like about choosing it as your first movie, and
we'll choose it. Maybe we should save it for like women in horror month.
I love that movie. Please pick it sometime.
I grew up with it.
Me too.
Okay, yeah.
John. Oh.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Okay, well, let's not say anything else about it then, since John doesn't see.
So, thanks. What do you think of,
appreciate you guys.
Yeah. Oh, you know what scene I loved? Lucille, when she's fucking scraping the spoon against the fucking teacup or the bowl, because she's so, like, fucking mad.
It's such a great detail, isn't it?
Oh, it made me cringe in real life. I was just like, holy shit. I let it play, though, because it bothered me. But I was like, oh, it's so effective. Because they do it like twice.
Yeah, I wonder if Jordan Peele stole that for Get Out.
Maybe, yeah.
I was
thinking about a little bit.
But that has like a pleasant kind of tinkling sound to
well,
it.
It's supposed to hypnotize you.
Discordant, you know, like
she's it's like
yeah. It was cringy to me. I mean, it really was. I mean, even in Get Out, I was just like, "Hey, God!"
Oh, really? Oh, don't like that.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, when Lucille does it, I feel like it's just a tiny choice, but so good because it reflects her bad intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Not really
yeah,
trying
I
to
like
her bad health. She's trying to kill her, and she's like, "I promise, you're gonna leave that bed." And then you know that in her mind, she's like, "In a coffin, like
in a body bag."
Yeah,
I did love her death. I thought her death was good. I thought it was filmed pretty good.
And also brutal.
Yeah. Yeah, the final hit.
But dude, where she's running around that castle in that billowing nightgown, I mean, she looks
her
like
bosom's
a...
bosom's just floating.
Well, she looks beautiful, but she also looks like an insane harpy. I mean, like...
She reminded me maybe of a Stepford wife. Like, she's, you know, almost... She got the nightgown.
No, I mean, it's she reminded me of like a Hammer heroine. You remember I was saying
when we
Countess Dracula, like, is it even a Hammer movie if there's not like a long billowing nightgown? And so Chastain's got this long billowing gown on. I think she's got a cape or a robe or something on over it, but it's flying out behind her like bat wings, you know, and she's racing around and she's like insane with rage. And I mean, she looks like an insane, like, devil woman. But also beautiful, and it's just like this crazy, like grotesque mix, and I love it. Ugh.
I do too.
Yeah, so good.
I like when she stabs her brother in the face.
Oh my God. Oh, dude, I love that.
It was like, ooh.
However,
you
the
said
reality
that so exactly.
The reality of it is that you're not punching through a skull that easy, right?
I mean, that blade was pretty sharp.
Well, if you hit one of those, like, sinus cavities, maybe?
Yeah, she went, like, under the
maybe.
Cheek.
It wasn't, like, in the brain area where,
no,
you
know,
you
went through his eye.
It was kind of, like, almost through the gums, maybe? Like, under the cheekbone?
I'm feeling my cheekbone. There's no way.
Yeah, but you don't have cheekbones like
easy.
Tom Hiddleston, bro. Come on.
That's true.
You're a leading man.
Even,
come on. We don't have leading more. Man cheekbones, John.
I don't. I really don't. But the thing is like, even my cheekbones are kind of tough, but Tom Hiddleston's are, like, titanium.
Yeah.
There's no way a knife would have gone through there.
That's one of the funniest things you've ever said. You don't have Tom Hiddleston's cheekbone.
Yeah. I mean, let's be real.
Oh my God.
No, I got Heidelberg's cheekbones.
Well, then you're quite handsome.
Thank you.
And then, of course, at the end, we find out that, you know, the book that she's, you know, written her book, and it's like her own story. Called Crimson Peak. So it's like the story we just mm-hmm. saw.
Slute.
Slute. Kind of like The Outsiders. Did you ever read The Outsiders in school?
The Others?
The Outsiders.
Yes.
Yes.
Tony Curtis. You read that? Yeah. And it's like he's telling the whole story from the first person. And at the end, he has to write a paper for school. And it, in the last chapter, it says he starts out writing and it's the first line of the book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like,
I love that.
Oh, the book was like them telling their own story.
That movie was fucking awesome, by the way, too.
It
so good.
Never gets old.
Great cast.
Getting their start in it. Yeah.
If you like that movie, watch Red Dawn.
Yeah.
Seen it?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. It's got a lot of the same cast.
That one's sad, though, man.
Yeah.
Well, so is The Outsiders.
Do it for Johnny, man.
Oh, boy. Stay gold.
Oh, my God.
Ralph Macchio. Anyway. Holy fuck.
Do you guys, anything else you guys want to touch on?
Can we just talk about Outsiders now?
Talk about the what?
Outsiders? Yep.
I'm just kidding.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm just kidding. But no, that's I think that's all I wanted to say about Crimson Peak. What do y'all? What about y'all?
I'm good. You wanna drop your review?
Yeah, let's do it. So I'll keep it pretty short. I think it's pretty clear how I feel about this movie. I find the story really entertaining. I love literally every choice made in this movie with honestly my only complaint is really the CGI, and I can't even like blame Del Toro for that because, you know, you do what you can with what you have. But like all of the visual choices are so beautiful. The sound design is so spot on. The set design is so perfect. I love the story. I love the way secrets are revealed in this.
I love the colors. I love the actors. Like every single one of the actors, I think was a great choice for their respective roles. I love the acting performances. I find Mia Wasikowska to be very sympathetic and someone you really want to root for and somebody you want to see win. And Lucille, as alluring in a strange way as she is, like, I want to see her defeated, you know, and I want Hiddleston to be defeated. I don't want him to get the girl at the end. You know, once those secrets are revealed, like the secrets are salacious and I enjoy the reveal of the secrets, but then that changes, you know, how we feel about these characters. Oh, I meant to mention the scene where Edith goes to identify her father's body and she sees him and she sort of breaks down. And for a few moments, it seems like she's having trouble accepting reality. And she's like, oh, this, you know, he's going to do this. And she's talking about him in the present tense. I found it really heartbreaking. I thought it was such a good performance and I really felt for her in that scene. I thought it was just a nice bit of acting, but not over the top. You know, it wasn't like screaming and shrieking and hysterical. It was like just the right poignance, I guess. Hair and makeup, costuming, lighting, all of it gorgeous. I love the dialogue that was written. It was Del Toro and I forget the other screenwriter, but he co-wrote it with one other person. And there's just so many subtle touches in the dialogue that controls how much information we as the audience know. And it's like, you know, it's like one of those little machines that dispenses pellets to rats, you know, lab rats or whatever, that they get just a little bit at a time. And, you know, no matter how fast they hit the lever, like you only get the one pellet. And I feel like that's how Del Toro is giving us information. Like we're curious to know all the secrets, but we only get a little bit at a time. But eventually by the end, we're satisfied and we found out, you know, everything there was to know. And it feels satisfying to me. There's one bit of dialogue that I love and it's when things are really unraveling for Lucille and Edith is really starting to feel uneasy, like very acutely uneasy around Lucille. And Lucille is, oh, it's when she's burning the pages of her book, and which is of course crushing to somebody who wants to be a writer. And she turns and she kind of very just nonchalantly says, oh, you thought you were going to be a writer. And it's just like so devastating to the ego. You know, like that's something she was aspiring to. And, you know, you so desperately want approval and recognition from people and for somebody to just utterly dismiss you like that. And it's delivered so casually, like Chastain, she just says the line so casually, but it's so devastating. But then, of course, we know Edith kind of gets the last laugh there. So I really enjoy this movie. I really love it. It's something that I was excited to talk about. It's something that I would watch repeatedly. I feel like this is a comfort movie for me. Like I already want to watch it again. And I don't know. It's my flavor. You know, some movies are just your flavor and some aren't, but this is definitely my flavor. And well, you know, I have several flavors, but this is one of them. I love it. And so I'm going to give I wouldn't say it's like an all-time fave, like Rosemary's Baby. I don't think it's quite in that like absolute elite tier, but I think it's in the tier just below. So I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 blood red mountains.
Blood red mountains. I love it.
Yeah. 9 out of 10 blood red mountains. That's my score.
Nice. John, yes.
What about you? What do you think?
Well, you guys have really, both you and Heidelberg have really talked me up on this movie. You know, I was like right down the middle. It was an entertaining movie. I, like you, I love the setting of it. I love the acting. Maybe there was a little lack of chemistry, but I don't know what it was. There's just something that did not connect me to this movie. But it was entertaining. I would suggest, especially Jacqueline, if people are fans of gothic horror, you know, this is definitely a movie to watch. You know, the settings are beautiful. My big knock on it really is the CGI. The CGI just, it really took me out of the movie. But then again, I can counteract that with great acting. You know, we had great characters. I think this movie was cast perfectly. You know, even like Charlie Hunnam, you know, a guy that you associate playing Jax Teller on Sons of Anarchy, you know, as being a badass. He just, and you said that Guillermo really kind of focused him towards, you know, playing the damsel in distress. And you saw that. I mean, it was done flawlessly. Mm-hmm. Settings were great. The kills were actually really good. You know, the stabbing to the face or the dad getting his face bashed in. By the way, I wouldn't think that a sink back in those days would be able to break that easy, but I think it added to effect. You know, these things were like heavy duty plaster with the big.
Well, that's
metal
why his face is bashed in.
Like, yeah, exactly.
That's how hard he was.
No, I understand that, but you wouldn't think that something back in the day it was heavy duty. Anyways, this movie wasn't for me, but like with The Shining, and hopefully eventually we can do that, and I can explain why. This movie is not my cup of tea, but I appreciated it for what it was. I love Guillermo del Toro. I loved what was it, Labyrinth and The Devil's Backbone and a bunch of other movies that he's done that I really appreciated. But I've come up, guys. I'm at a 5.5 out of 10. What was it?
Blood Red Mountains.
Blood Red Mountains. So I'm going to go a 5.5 out of 10 Blood Red Mountains for me.
All right. Okay. I think that's respectable. I get it. Hi,
Jabbar. I'm curious where you were to begin. You were at a 5?
4.55.
But I gave it a flaccid, so I thought that was... I equate a flaccid around a 5.
No, I can't say this movie sucks, because the movie doesn't suck. It's just, it's not my thing.
Gotcha.
I get that. Hydraberg, what about you? I'm curious.
10 out of 10. No, I'm just kidding.
That's it.
10 out of 10, baby. Blood-soaked orgies. No, yeah. I love the aesthetic of this film. From the costuming to the set design, it's gorgeous. There's everything about it's gorgeous. There's a great dreamlike state, we said, or love, love slash ghost story vibe to it, aesthetic to it. Like, you could open up a book in a library and there's Crimson Peak, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I like that. The castle itself is amazing, I think, to shoot in, whatever, how much is practical. It's just, they do a really great job. It looks like there's like painstaking detail in every like piece of the scenery, you know what I mean, whether we see it or not. So I could see rewatches with this too, like unearthing certain things. We're like just his workshop, there's so many little things going on back there, and there's environmental storytelling, which I always appreciate in a video game or a movie or anything like that can do that. I think that's great. I think the creature effects and the horror of it all looks and holds up pretty nicely for the most part. But yes, the film does lean on CGI a little bit, and it holds up, but it doesn't in certain areas. It's a mixed bag, but I do love the way the apparitions look. Like, I enjoy their design. I like the wispy nature to them. I like the fact that you can see some of their humanity still a little bit, but they're grotesque too. You're seeing bone, and like the look of the mother, I thought was especially cool. Bathed in like black.
Her mother.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Her mother, especially. The mother wasn't bad either, the one with the hatchet. I mean, the cleaver in the head, but I thought the acting, for the most part, drew me in. Like this gothic love tale of it all. I thought Chastain's performance especially was great, where she subdued in the beginning, but obviously something's going on under there with her character. And then just like full blown, like, what? Crazy bitch. Give my brother a hand job. That's right. But yeah, I think they were all cast pretty well. I told you Hunnam wasn't my bag exactly, but you know, he's not terrible either. But I do really love the intrigue of this story. I thought it involves you pretty well in the story. It keeps you guessing. And that's tough for a film like this. Sometimes I do. I thought it does a decent bit with that. There's more than just the incest too. There's other things at foot. I kind of wish I knew more about the clay. Like, I don't know. It's just clay. It's just, I don't know that. It feels like there's this magical property almost to it, but they don't really go into it in the film. I kind of wish it came into play more. It's interesting. I don't know. Because it gives a really cool set. It's almost like it's put in there for that, you know, for the later set piece. There's just some great filmmaking here, though. Del Toro's an expert at storytelling and filmmaking. He's an expert storyteller and filmmaker. Like, I just love when he does his thing. I think there's some fantastic edits here and transitions in this movie. I love the beginning with the moths to the flame as the lantern stays bright and the scene around it darkens. And then we transition
to the book cover. I think it's called like a pinhole wipe.
Yeah.
Keyhole wipe or something like that. Like zeroes in on like a small image and then closes up.
Chef's kiss in that scene because the moths are being drawn to the flame. We don't know yet that the moths have a semblance because of later on at Crimson Peak. That's all they have.
Halloween 1978 did it better with the pumpkin.
I don't really get the.
That's a little different. Is that?
Yeah,
is
I'm
that,
not really.
Is that also the same kind of wipe? I'm not sure, but I know
it's
what
like
you're talking.
Title card, but yeah.
Yeah,
we get it. You like Halloween.
I do.
But yes, yeah, it's an old fashioned kind of like transition, right?
Yeah, I just loved how they focused on the lantern too, just in particular in that one scene and with the moths. Yeah. I thought that was pretty cool. But yeah, I do have some cons though. Although I do like his character. I thought Hunnam's acting is not particularly the best. especially alongside the other actors. That's what it is too. You know what I mean? He's alongside Hiddleston and Chastain. He holds his own. Mostly he's not in the movie a ton, and you said he's a damsel, so that's fine. That's he serves the purpose for sure. I'm not a huge fan of the melodrama. Like, I like some of it, obviously you have to have it, but I think there's a little, it's a little bit drawn out here, or maybe we could focus on certain parts of it more. It brings the film down just a little bit for me, but I know you need it. The film leans heavily on it, yeah, obviously. And like I said, there were a couple parts where I didn't like lose interest, but I was just like, all right, what's the next beat? You know what I mean? Because I've seen this once before. So this time was a little different. You know, it's definitely a cool ride, though. And I think the happy ending at the end, I don't know if I love that. The whole, like, she gets away scot-free, like, she's okay. The poison doesn't kill her and nothing. And then Alan lives too. I don't know. That's felt a little blah for a gothic horror. I was like, you didn't go there in the end, there, really. Mm. No main characters died. Besides her dad, right? And then, or you know, well, they're main characters, but you know what I mean. Overall, though, I really do enjoy the story. And you can just see this film is like a labor of love for Del Toro. And I love that any film that does that, you know, can achieve that on celluloid or digital, whatever you want to call it. Like, I think that's cool when you can see somebody's dreams or aspirations on film. It's not just a job at that on that one project.
Yeah.
That's why we love Del Toro, because almost everything he does is one of those kind of projects.
You know, he loves what he's. If he's doing it, it's because he loves it.
Yeah.
So before you give you a score, Heidelberg, Jacqueline, is this a book or is this just something out of Del Toro's head?
It's just out of his head.
I think there might be writings after this because of this, maybe.
Like, oh man, that's impressive. That's very impressive.
I thought I saw some books.
Oh, you know, I think he's obviously very well versed in ghost stories, and this is just, and you know, he makes a lot of ghost stories himself in his films. Like, this is not his only ghost story. I think it's a comfortable like subgenre for him. And I think he really likes stories about ghosts, and I think, you know, I don't know anybody who does it better, honestly. In modern times.
Agreed. I'm impressed by that. I really am. So go ahead, Heidelberg. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's all good. I'm gonna give this with all that said, I'm going to give this a 7 out of 10 blood-soaked mountains with room to grow.
Okay. Blood-red mountains. Got it. Okay.
Blood-red mountains.
Yep. All right. Well, that's cool. I'm glad you guys didn't hate this. But yeah, it's just, you know, it scratched an itch for me. And, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like, you know, as an adult, and I don't live in Orlando anymore, watching this movie kind of allows me to have that same feeling as I did when I went on the Haunted Mansion as a kid. It's like I sort of fantasize about living in this like rundown but sublimely beautiful, like you know, gothic mansion, and it kind of gives me that same feeling, and it like sparks my imagination in the same way. It's just a comfortable place for me to be. So thanks for going along on the ride with me.
Yeah, I also think like this is, there's not too many movies like this, so this is like its own sort of thing. Like, I could see owning this because this is a cool tale to be like, oh, you've never seen, you know, like it's a niche kind of thing. Like you said, there's definitely homages in this to other things if you like what you see here, but I don't think there's anything else like Crimson Peak per se. So
yeah, I feel like, you know, there were
not recently
quite a few
you know, gothic haunted house movies that had a similar flavor back in like the 50s and 60s. And I think you said it earlier, Heidelberg, I think this is a little bit of a throwback to that. Like, you know, he, Del Toro clearly loves those types of films and wanted to make one of his own. And so this is like a 21st century version of that. And so I appreciate that a lot.
I also want to correct myself. I said the movie Labyrinth. Pan's Labyrinth, I love, from Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah. I didn't even pick up on that, so you got it.
The babes.
The babes. Y'all want to hear, you remind me of the babe. Would you guys like to hear a little trivia?
Yeah.
Certainly.
All right. There's a lot, so I'm going to try to pick and choose. I'm not going to bore you with all of it, but I'll try to choose the best ones. Okay, so John, you were saying something about the house, like, oh, I'm sure some of it was CGI'd, but it still looked really good, and it looks like it looks real. Mm-hmm. The house was built in its entirety. That is real set. But it had to be torn down at the end of the shoot to make space in the studio, which is a shame. But that is a gorgeous set.
Yeah, it was.
And everything in the house was made for the house. They didn't like reuse parts from other places. Like everything was made for the house, which blows my mind. Like that must have gotten so expensive.
Yeah. How big was the budget for this movie?
I have the answer to that, actually. The budget was $55
million. Ooh, that's pretty hefty.
Yep, but it had a good return on investment. It made $74.7 million at the box office.
Nice. So, very nice.
So at least it turned out to be worth it from the studio's point of view, but as well, I think it should. I think it deserves to be successful. Let's see. We already said that. Del Toro claims that one of the inspirations for the film was an actual supernatural event that happened to him while he was location scouting for the Hobbit trilogy when he was originally set to direct the Hobbit films. Mm-hmm. He and some of the members of the production crew stayed at a supposedly haunted hotel in New Zealand. And Del Toro said that one night after midnight, he could hear sounds that sounded like a murder taking place, like screaming and whimpering and just ruckus. And it seemed as though it was coming from a vent leading to an empty bathroom. And that was the basis for the sequence in the film when Edith finds the Sharp's mother in the bathtub.
Right. So that's kind
of the little seedling of the idea.
Okay, so this movie came out before the Hobbit trilogy?
I have no idea.
No, well, I guess if it was based off the story that he experienced in Australia when he was filming the Hobbit, I guess that would have come out before. And then that inspired this movie.
I guess I don't know.
He didn't film The Hobbit. He was up to do it.
Yeah, he ended up filming it. So who knows how far in advance that was.
He was working on it for sure.
Yeah.
It was the first pick.
He didn't do it. So I really don't know the timeline on that.
Yeah.
Jessica Chastain learned how to play the piano for this movie and performed the songs by herself, which I think is pretty impressive. And she had also, you remember she was in the movie Mama?
Oh, fuck yeah. That was a great movie.
I didn't see that movie.
So Del Toro was a producer on that movie, and she learned the bass guitar for that movie.
Oh, wow. Shit.
Chastain. She just picked
up instruments, you know?
Dude, that's why she's like the actor of the generation, you know? She's generational.
Yep. This was an interesting fact. I didn't pick up on this, but again, you know, we were talking about, on rewatch, you pick up new details on a movie like this. Many of the pieces of furniture in the film were made in two sizes. So when a character sits on it or appears in the background, it can show certain emotion. So if the furniture is bigger, it makes the character look weak or small or vulnerable. But then there are times when the character is like near or sitting on a piece of furniture that's the same thing, but smaller. And that's meant to show them becoming more strong or determined.
Okay. There is like moments where like Edith's in like the chair and she's not feeling well. And it does look like the chair is like really like she's almost like a little kid sunken into it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. The vulnerable, like you said. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I have to notice later when she turns it on Chastain how she probably looks more propped up maybe.
Right. So that's something I want to pay attention to on the next watch, but I just thought I thought that was interesting. I'd mention it. Del Toro and Tom Hiddleston both say this was the best set they've ever worked on.
Yeah, that's because he got what's her name to grab his ass? Hiddleston's ass.
Yeah, no, like the set itself, like the house. Del Toro wrote the part of Edith's father specifically for the actor Jim Beaver after seeing him in Deadwood.
I forgot about that. Oh my god, that's what I know.
He's from Deadwood.
Oh, is Deadwood?
Nice. Yeah, Deadwood's good.
Okay. Fucking great show.
Yeah, HBO.
I was gonna say, is that an HBO show? Yeah. I haven't seen an HBO show.
Timothy Oliphant's in that, right?
He is. Yeah, before he was in Justified.
Yep.
Should I watch that? Should I watch Deadwood?
Okay. It's not Western. Too long.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So the character of Thomas was originally going to be played by Benedict Cumberbatch, but then was replaced by Tom Hiddleston. So.
Yeah, because they go to Cumberland Ranch, so that's why they can't have him in there. It's too many cumbers. Too cumbersome.
Too cumbersome.
Dr. Strange was going to play this, but Loki ended up playing this part.
Yeah.
Got it.
And Emma Stone was originally going to be Edith, but she strikes me so strong and confident, which is not to say that the character of Edith is not strong and confident, but I feel like Edith also really needs to be like have a vulnerability to her, and I feel like Mia Wasikowska has more of that than Emma Stone. What do you guys think?
Agreed. I think Emma is a very strong presence on screen. No matter what she's in, she's very strong. I think
you
want
more of that Mia Farrow sort of vibe in this. Yeah. And, you know, like the daintier sort of woman or more of a... But she's fearless, though, we find out, you know what I mean? But at first, it's like, just looking at her, she's like, she's a smaller woman.
Right, but that's her character arc. I mean, that's that's how she becomes... stronger and stuff like that, but yeah, Emma Stone would like just own it and every single scene.
I mean, she's good.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah. So this, I can totally relate to this. Jessica Chastain once confessed in an interview that when she was a teenager, her looks were reminiscent of the attire worn by her character Lucille. So she had a little goth vibe going. She said, "Perhaps doing Crimson Peak brought all of that love for the gothic aesthetic back." She said, "My friend and I used Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1992 as our reference. We were Winona Ryder and Sadie Frost. She wore black lipstick and I wore a black red lip color, like dried blood almost." So again, like, I so relate to that.
I just don't picture you or Jessica Chastain going through that goth phase. I mean, I understand you love this movie, but I just don't picture it.
I'll find you some old photos from high school and you might
please do. Oh, that would be great. I won't share them with anybody, but that would be fantastic seeing you in your goth phase.
I'll post it. There's not a lot of photos, but because you know, I was afraid of the light, but I'll if I find them.
I love that.
The trailer for this movie features the PJ Harvey cover of Red Right Hand. I assume you guys know that song. Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we all know the Nick Cave version, but the trailer for this had a PJ Harvey cover of it.
Oh, wow.
Let's see. Yeah, Doug Jones portrayed Lady Sharp and Edith's mother as the ghosts, and he portrayed Pan in Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
And he also played the thin infected man creature in the movie Quarantine, which was a remake of the Spanish film Wreck that we covered some time ago.
Mm-hmm. Rocked him. Hardly knew him.
Damn, well done. Well done.
Tom Hiddleston and Mia Wasikowska appeared in a film together back in 2013, which was Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive.
I've never seen that yet.
I haven't either, but they were both in that, so that's cool.
Is that the one with what's her name?
Yeah, it is. Okay.
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
They're like vampire lovers or something.
Oh, I need to watch that because I loved Tilda Swinton is one of my favorite actors.
what do you guys think, real quick? We need to talk about Kevin. Do you think we could cover that on the show?
I mean. It's a horrifying movie.
We don't need to cover that.
What?
I'm just kidding. I say we don't need to cover that.
It's, I mean, I would say it's like horror adjacent.
Okay.
It's like pretty funny games.
I mean, it's a drama, but it's horrifying.
I watched that movie and it fucked me up. It was just like one of those movies you go, ooh, what? Really? Yeah. Oh.
I had never seen anything quite like that. And then I read the book, which absolutely blew my fucking brain out of my head.
I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fan of Ezra. I just...
The actor himself is, like, pretty fucked up.
I'm just like hey, whenever he's on screen, I just don't like him.
Oh, he's, like, he's a bad dude in real life.
That's right. That's why I translate Ezra on Miller. Screen, I think. Ezra Miller is a piece of shit. No, we're not covering that movie. Fuck that.
Okay. Well, just read the book. Read the book, you guys. It'll blow your brain out of your head. So, anyway.
Okay, sorry. Go, continue.
You know what else is going to blow your brain out of your head? This trivia fact. According to Tom Hiddleston, there was no stunt woman for the scene where Lucille pushes Edith over the banister.
What?
Yeah, Mia Wasikowska did an acrobatic flip on wires and landed on a mattress to cushion her fall. Dude, that was a brutal fall. I thought she
bashed herself on that one banister on the way down.
Yeah, I thought she was going to have a broken back. Not a leg. But here we are. So that was pretty brave of her, I think, to do that stuff.
Thanks, Guillermo, for putting a freaking mattress there so I didn't break my back completely.
Yeah, thanks.
On the snow.
I fractured a few vertebrae, but you know what? I'm fine.
Yeah, it's all good.
Yep. I think that's about all I've got. So I think those are the best trivia facts. That's it.
Nice. Hey, can I bring up real quick? Cinemigos, I know we do it at the very end of the show, but Heidelberg, John, and Rob, you guys covered a movie that is near and dear to my heart. It's a movie I've seen like dozens of times, Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone. What a fantastic episode. Go check out the latest episode of Cinemigos. And if you guys did not mention that little weight machine, the Nautilus thing, I know you did, but if you didn't, I would have been really pissed off.
That thing's so ridiculous.
Dude.
That movie is just such a product of its time.
Yeah.
And also, it just happens that we dropped it the weekend of Father's Day. It's like a perfect Father's Day sort of movie. And I, too, saw it a ton when I was young.
Yeah, absolutely. It was on HBO like every other day. Isn't his son, Sage Stallone, his son that actually passed away?
Yeah.
Like his son in the movie?
Oh.
No, the actor isn't, though. No.
Yeah. No, the actor was, right?
That's not his son.
That's not Sage Stallone?
No, I don't believe that's his son. That was another actor. That actor's in, he's in the Flight of the Navigator. He's in a couple
of those. Right. That's right. I'm sorry. It was like Rocky IV or something like that that he was in, actually in.
What's up, Jacko?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm sorry. I had to mention.
Oh, we have a commentary too. I'm working on it, getting it out soon. I just got to make sure it syncs up perfectly and edit a little bit. But me and Rob did a watch along of Over the Top and commentaried it. So I'm going to release that as a bonus soon.
Sounds cool. Nice. I have a couple of other great things coming up soon for Cinemigos. So everybody should stay tuned and listen to that. Heidelberg, do you want to talk about what we're doing here on A Cut Above next week?
Oh, yeah. So next week is technically like your pick. It's supposed to be your week or whatever. But we're kicking off next week a 4-podcast extravaganza. Not since the Children of the Cornucopia crossover has there been a collaboration of this magnitude. We got us covering Critters from 1986. Then we got Gimme Back My Action and Horror Movies covering Critters 2, The Main Course. That's a really good one, by the way. Spoils of Horror, covering part 3, and then Bringing Up the Rear, Cinema Slab, covering part 4. Sorry, guys. We're doing a 4-podcast collaboration on the Critters. I got the box set right here.
Factory.
I'm ready to go. I'm going to watch all the films, by the way, guys, just to make sure. So the pain that you guys feel on the fourth one or the third, I want to feel it too. So
You're
super enthusiastic right now.
Yeah, I really want to drum up some excitement for this collaboration.
On a serious note, I was not able to be a part of the collaboration for Children of the Corn, and I missed it, but I'm very excited about this collaboration that we're doing.
Yeah. Oh, and we're having Amy Burke on.
Oh,
yeah. Amy Burke.
So we got an ace up our sleeve as far as who's got the best episode.
Well, John, I'm glad you're going to be here for this one, too. And I'll also say, this is a bigger collaboration than the Children of the Corn collaboration, because we only had 3 podcasts covering
Anna and Hannah.
We have 4. So Anna and Hannah and Hunter are going to do part 4. So it's even bigger and better. It's growing. That's what we're going to be talking about next week. In the meantime, if you want to share your thoughts on Crimson Peak with us, or if you want to share your thoughts on Critters before we record our episode, send us an email
at acutabovehorrorreview@gmail.com. You can also follow us on X at @cutabovehorror.
You can follow us on Instagram at @acutaboveoneword.horror_review.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook, A Cut Above Horror Review. Also, we're looking for those 5-star ratings on Spotify and iTunes. I mean, you can write a review on iTunes, but do it for A Cut Above Horror Review. Also, do it for the Cinemigos. Make sure you get in the word out there about your favorite 2 podcasts.
Absolutely.
So next week, go find Critters, the first one from 1986.
They're all on Tubi.
Excellent. Tubi, so clutch. So clutch. Yeah, go find Critters on Tubi from 1986. Watch, you know, all the first 4 movies. Watch the whole thing if you want to. If you feel like you're, you know, you want to be really in on this collaboration and follow along with all 4 of those podcasts next week. Everybody's going to release their episode next week. So feel free. Just watch the whole franchise and get really familiar with those critters. And then meet us back here next week to hear what we thought about it.
And keep it peaky.